And if you're partnering with people, make sure that you have your four or five core values that you hire, fire, promote, and demote on. It's a really big piece of how we do all of our business now. Otherwise, if people don't align in core values, then they're never going to align in your business.
Welcome back to the Investing with Purpose podcast, where we explore the intersection of success and significance. We discuss alternative investment options from our experience buying hundreds of millions of dollars worth of real estate, but most importantly, how we're using that business to impact people in a positive way to leave a legacy that matters. Let's get after it.
We are officially live, Stephen, on the Go Big Live Real Estate Investors Podcast. How are you feeling today?
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. The inaugural run. What an honor.
Thanks a lot for coming on when we are in the green room, so to speak, that you are my first guest and you are an impressive guest at that. Stephen manages over 2,200 residential and self-storage units and has about, $100 million in assets under management?
Yeah, it's closer to like 200 now.
All right. You know, big things. The focus of this podcast is really our target audience is active real estate investors that are looking to go big. A lot of them are prevented by going big, like I was, just through paralysis of fear. It's a totally different animal in terms of when you're graduating from single through four family to, let's say, 5, 10, 20, 200 unit type of deals. So we really want to take the opportunity with this show to really kind of take that first intimidating big hairy monster deal that was at least a big hairy monster to you when you decided to go big and kind of just talk about the origin of that deal. But before we do that, I definitely want to have a little bit of time for you to talk about yourself and what your origin is. So you were born, you're here now. What happened in between, Stephen?
So much. 41 years old this year. So we've been in real estate for 15 years. I was a broker before that. So I was a broker. I went to Boston University for school, majored in liberal arts, and got a degree in sociology. Had a blast in college, almost too much fun. And then got out and started doing some sales jobs in Manhattan. So I was selling payroll and tax filing services for like ADP and Paychex and riding an escalator and elevator and getting off at every floor in a Manhattan building and knocking on the door and talking to people. And my sister-in-law ended up getting a franchise that sold REO properties. So I was a broker first and I was sourcing these REO properties from banks and I was selling them to investors. So I didn't love showing somebody 1,000 houses and then them making emotional decisions. So we started going the investor route and learning that there was a method to their madness. They would go in, they'd get a strategy in terms of flip, how much budget there is, what the comps are on the exit. And it was just a math deal, right? So at that point, I could put together a full deal to an investor base and say, hey, I have this deal. This is, we can sell it for X, put in this much, sell it for Y. And recently I reconnected with this guy, but the reason I got out of that business was I sold a property that had a pool ladder that was stolen out of the pool. It was a bank owned property. You can't get in. So the guy is at closing and he said, you know, I want you to pay for the pool ladder out of your commission, right? So I'm making 2.5% and half of it's going to my broker and half of it's coming to me. And he wants me to pay for this $400 pool ladder. So I paid for it. We got it closed. And the next day I decided I just can't work for other people anymore. So we went and started wholesaling properties. We started wholesaling and flipping. We did about 1,000 flips over the next 7 years. It was not, that sounds much more glamorous than it is, by the way. For the first 2 or 3 years, we had to borrow mortgage payments and try to figure out how to do side jobs because we just didn't know what we were doing, but we figured it out. And I think the max deals I did was 15 or 16 with me and my business partner in 1 year. And then we ended up joining a mastermind and seeing that these other guys were doing 100 plus flips a year. And I was like, man, we're not doing that. How do you do it? And that next year we did 75 deals. The year after that, we did 150 deals and we were off to the races. And then we were getting crushed in taxes. So anything up until that point?
No, you keep going.
All right. Cause this is going to lead into the big aha, right? We were paying 37% ordinary income tax on wholesales and flips. And then a New Jersey state tax on top of it. So almost half of our money was going to taxes. And then I have a business partner. So half the money's going back to that. And then the business is a cash eating machine, right? We're spending $60,000 a month in marketing and then getting crushed in taxes. So one of our friends says, hey, you should buy an apartment building or do a commercial deal so that you could get depreciation to write off some of the active income that you're creating through flips and wholesales. And we said, okay, how do we do that? I don't know how to own and operate and buy an apartment building. We don't have a track record. I can't get the loan because it's, you know, they're big deals. And they said, you know, you should just go find a partner, find an operator that's established and help them raise some capital. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's interesting. I could partner with somebody else's experience. We already had experience raising some money because we were flipping houses. So we were raising private money to do that. We weren't just using hard money lenders. So we just kind of put some feelers out there and said, hey, if you know anybody looking to raise for a deal, let us know. We're looking to deploy some capital. A guy reaches out to me and he says, hey, I'm building an 1,183-unit self-storage complex, ground up. It's going to be managed by CubeSmart. It's a $14 million deal. We need $4 million in equity, and we'll get the rest on a construction loan. And I was like, man, that's a little bit bigger than I thought I wanted to go. Right?
How big did you think you were going to go? Like, did you have it in your mind? It's like, oh, maybe $500,000 would be, you know,
I thought maybe raise. $2 or $3 million building, right? I thought maybe we'd have to bring $500,000 to $1 million in equity and buy a small apartment complex, and that would be it. So now this $12 million opportunity is facing me, and you have two options, right? Faith or fear. We decided to say yes on a deal we've never did before and with a partner we've never done it before. So we have a lot of conversations, get through the core value conversation. If you're partnering with people, make sure that you have your four or five core values that you hire, fire, promote, and demote on. It's a really big piece of how we do all of our business now. Otherwise, if people don't align in core values, then they're never going to align in your business. So got through that. We said, okay, let's do this deal. And for the next 65, 70 days, we scrambled trying to raise $4 million. We did it. We went, closed, and we got this big, beautiful piece of dirt. 14 acres. And we flew down there and we watched some dirt movers. I think we spent $400,000 to remove the dirt that was on the property to make it level. And we were down there watching big dirt movers move some dirt around. And that was our first deal. So $14 million deal. And in that same year, we did two more. So we built just about 450,000 square feet of self-storage in and around the Orlando area managed by CubeSmart. But that was the first big deal.
So where did this money come from? First of all, let's back up a little bit. Where did the deal come from on this? Because you said you got a phone call from a guy. Like, was this just a guy that was just dialing the white pages?
It was social media. So we posted on Facebook that we were looking to deploy capital, get into the commercial space. And if anybody knew anybody, and a friend of mine knew of our partner, Sean. And Sean shot me a Facebook message and he said, hey, let's get on a phone call. I want to talk to you about this potential deal. And he just finished raising. So his investors were kind of tapped on another project. And he said, this is how we can structure this deal. And we said, all right, well, yeah, let's see the pitch deck. Let's see the underwriting. Let's dig into it. And also tell me what questions I'm not asking that I should be because I've never done this before. And he was really gracious. He held our hand through the whole process. He helped get us on some pitch calls to talk to investors and learn how to present the opportunities and things like that. So the deal came from really a friend of a friend through social media. So $14 million project, we ended up making several million dollars on it. And it was because of a Facebook post.
So where'd that friend come from?
Where did the friend who knew him come from?
Yeah.
It was a mastermind.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a single family mastermind too. And he just knew of this other guy doing commercial deals.
Okay. So somebody that was like in that real estate track that came from a mastermind that, okay. Cause this is like a lot of times when I talk to my students is about like where these relationships come from and how they like bloom and like how they first germinate and stuff like that. That's definitely awesome to know.
Yeah.
So you got this opportunity, you got $4 million you got to raise. Like, did you have like, hey, these are the materials, you know, just make a bunch of phone calls. Like, how did that specifically happen in terms of like where you landed your first investor?
So we already had some investors that were investing with us on the single family side, right? So I just went back to all of those investors and I had an honest conversation and said, hey, look, we're going to flip less houses and we're going to do more commercial real estate because the tax benefits are so great. Right? You can use accelerated depreciation to offset a lot of your taxable income. So, and the return profile is very similar. So what we were paying them on those single family deals, they're actually making a little bit more on the multifamily or self storage deals, and they're not paying taxes on that income. So it really exacerbated the income for them, right? So that was our first deal we did. And then we couldn't raise all the money. So we only raised about half of it. And I was starting to sweat. We're 30 days out. And I was like, what do we do? And I just called some other guys that I knew in the single family space that were raising private capital. And I said, hey, let's partner on this deal. We all want to get in the commercial space. I have this deal. Come help me raise this other $2 million and we'll get on the general partnership side of it. We'll walk through the process. We'll fly down there. We'll do the whole thing together. And I did. I found two really great partners that came back in with me and they helped finish out the raise so that we could get it closed.
So these people in the single family space, were they like colleagues of yours, like competitors, so to speak?
Nope, just all mastermind friends.
Okay, so this was a pretty powerful mastermind that's like paid you a lot of dividends.
It changed my life. I actually got published in Forbes talking about this conversation about how getting around the right people and mentors will literally change your life. If it's true that you're the average of the five people that you hang around, then you need to start hanging around better people and stop taking money advice from your broke friends, right? So getting around guys that are just so far ahead of you in terms of systems and processes and maybe time as well. It's just so invaluable. You don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? The Bible says there's nothing new under the sun. And that's true. You're not the first person to flip a house. You're not the first person to buy an apartment complex. So getting around those people that can show you that is worth the 15, 20, 25 grand or whatever you're going to drop into a mastermind. I mean, when I got into that mastermind, I couldn't even afford it. I had to ask the guy if he would take three separate payments of $8,000 each throughout the year because I desperately wanted to be in, but we couldn't afford it at the time. And I mean, I would say in the first month, just a couple of these tips and tricks that I got from guys was changing our lives and changing our business. So yeah, that mastermind was super powerful. I mean, it's still going on today. It's still one of the biggest single family wholesale and flip development type masterminds. And there was a couple hundred people in there, but there was probably 15 or 20 really top level people doing 150, 200 flips. One guy was doing 1,000 flips a year.
Dude, yeah, Steven, like for 13 years, I was the one that was like banging my head against the wall, trying to figure out everything on my own. And when I first hired my own coach, it was like a very foreign concept to me. And then it was like, I discovered it was like the ultimate cheat code. Like, oh, yeah. Why hadn't anybody like just tried to bang this over my head? I was just resistant to it. So when I did hire my first coach, like I had an ROI on what I paid, which is a high ticket coaching program. I got 10x ROI in 1 month. So yeah, masterminds and programs are definitely, I swear by them. So you know, you got your $4 million raised, like you had a pitch deck that was sort of like prepared for you then.
So we worked with our partner on what he had used previously just to kind of understand what the layout was, but we kept it very simple. I think a lot of people complicate this space, even the way that we, I won't get into the granular details about it, but even the way that we fund these deals and how investors make money is very different than how I think a lot of people structure their funds or structure a PPM. Think about it this way. If you have a brain surgeon that's going to jump on a 30-minute webinar to talk about an investment model, try not to need to teach him how to get a finance degree in the process, right? He knows what he does and he does it really well. So the simpler, the better, in my opinion. I know that I'm probably one of the few guys that structure a deal to where it's just very calculable return, right? We pay between 12 and 16% depending on performance, but 12 is the floor and it could go up from there with profit participation, but that's it. When you start talking hurdles and waterfalls, and if this is foreign to anybody, when you start to get into this space, you'll start to understand that a lot of these underwriters look at things as in terms of IRR hurdles and waterfalls. And what that means is internal rate of return. Hurdle, meaning once I get a certain return, then the split changes between you and me, Mr. Investor. And then the third is the waterfall. How does that get distributed? So it's a very complex process invented by private equity firms to, I'm sure, keep kind of common knowledge guy out of these deals, which I hate. We were regular guys. We're blue collar guys. Like we wanted to go figure that out as well. So anyway, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We just wanted to give a very simple, straight, here's some pictures of the deal. Here's the metrics that we believe is going to happen. Here's what we think we're going to buy it for, build it for, sell it for after it's stabilized. And afterwards, we'll do a cost segregation study and we'll probably take, I think we took $5 million in depreciation on that $14 million deal in year one. And you're going to get massive write-offs. So does that sound good to you? And we did enough pitches on the single family side to know, hey, we're going to do a 5-slide PDF. And if you have questions, let me know. And that was it. That was the first deal. I mean, the slide deck was not complex. It wasn't, I still get offering memorandums because I'm a private investor as well now. And there's these 45-page pitch decks. I only look at one page, right? I look at the pro forma and I see if it's reasonable, but 45 pages, I got to click through to see where the numbers are, right? I'm a numbers guy. I want to see the numbers. So that being said, I kind of took an amalgamation of what we were using before in the residential space and what our partner had been using on multifamily deals. And we just chopped it up to like a 5 or 10 page presentation and just laid it out as simply as we could. I'm a big believer that a confused mind says no. And the more you talk, the more people get confused.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've raised millions of dollars just through a simple email with like bullet points of first, I start with how you're getting paid back, because I find that as an investor myself, I've looked at a lot of pitch decks and a lot of offering memorandums, and it's like how you're getting paid back is like the last thing that's in these things that are presented by these private equity people. And I'm like just flipping through the whole thing going towards the end, and even sitting in a investor presentation, they leave that at the to the end. And I'm like, and the whole time my ears are sort of halfway turned off, listening to this person thinking like, how is this guy paying me back? So just like I operate by the KISS principle, a lot of people are really surprised to like, oh, Matt, like this is how you actually present the actual deal, is like this just simple email. That being said, like, how did you first reach out to these like investors? It sounds like you had a relationship with them already. Did you like just send out an email? Did you make phone calls first and then send out an email? Like, did you like arrange like 100 lunch meetings? Like, how did that go?
Yeah. So we always do the same thing. We still do it. We send email and text blasts to invite people to a webinar. You can sign up to come to the webinar so you can see what it is that we're doing. And then if I don't get you on a webinar, then yeah, and I'm short, I'll start hammering phones, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just who opened the email. Let's start with them. The lowest hanging fruit. They opened the email. Hey, did you get my email? I sent you an invite to a webinar. We're doing something a little different. I think you'd be interested in. Can you get on the next webinar? It's at Friday at 3, whatever.
And is that how you did your first self-storage deal?
Yep, exactly. At the time, running a pretty sophisticated single family business. So we had a CRM that had investors and cash buyers for the wholesales. And so we had a database of probably 600 or 700 people already that were in there. And if a lot of your students are single family, like, make sure you hold on to the numbers of all the sellers, right? Whoever you've bought a house from, you just gave them a bunch of money. So they might need to deploy that money again, right? So there's a little hack for you. I think a lot of single family guys lose the numbers of the sellers that they purchase and they just continue to churn. But if you're ever going to raise money again, they already like, know, and trust you. So why wouldn't you go back to them and hit them up and say, hey, I just gave you a couple hundred grand. What are you going to do with that money? So we utilized that database and we did a bunch of webinars and we fumbled through the first few. John Maxwell says, experience isn't the greatest teacher, evaluated experience is. So as difficult as it is, make sure you record those webinars and go back and watch yourself on them and see how well you did when you were speaking to clients, where you stumbled, where you needed to get clean. There's actually a really cool AI bot that I'm surprised mine didn't sign in here, but it's called Yoodly, Y-O-O-D-L-I. And it'll join your Zoom meetings for you and it will record them. And then it'll give you notes on how many times you used a weak word, how many times you used or a replacement word or a repetitive word. Damn. And it gives you a lot of really cool insight. So utilize those things as tools to get better at pitching those deals, because the first time is going to suck, period, right? Because you're nervous, you haven't done it before. Especially if you're raising for a single family deal, like if it's really your first time, it's just not going to go great, right? So evaluate that experience and just keep getting better at how you're having that conversation.
So Stephen, how did you structure this first deal with, was it an LP, GP type of structure? That meaning general partner and limited partner. Can you kind of give me some flavor on that?
Yep, exactly. So it was a little bit different than a typical GPLP project because I think we raised the first deal. I forget if it was the first deal or the second deal. I think the first deal we did, we raised it as a note against the property. So there was a promissory note to the tune of $4 million at a 12%, I think, coupon. And it had to subordinate into second position because we had a big first position loan on it. So again, being single family guys, we didn't know what we didn't know. And when we came to the operator and said, well, you know, our people pay 12%, like that's what we're going to offer it at. He was like, okay, if you think you can raise capital at that rate, then let's do it. And we could. We were raising capital at 8 and 10% before on single family houses. So it was a note. But yes, typical GPLP, the notes were the LPs. We were on the GP side. They were capped, though, with their return profile. So it was just 12% flat until we sold the property. So that's really different. You won't see a lot of that. Even we don't do it now in the $100 million fund that we run. We do an equity kicker on top of a preferred return. So it's still a high pref, but it still also has an equity kicker, meaning you'll get some profit participation on top of that. So we structured it as notes. We put some money in, our partner put some money in, and after construction, it converted to probably a 10-year Fannie debt piece, and we were able to pay the investors back.
Okay. So on the structure here, notes, right? How did you get your bank cool with a lot of the equity coming from debt, essentially?
So they just had to subordinate the position. They didn't really care. It was a local bank. they said, as long as we're first position, then you guys could raise it as equity or debt or whatever. Right. So they didn't mind. And we just had to write it in the notes that it was subordinate to first position.
Okay. So that being
said, find that now.
Yeah. I have a lot of investors that just prefer just to get a fixed rate of return. So sometimes I've had lenders that are not cool with subordinated debt.
You can structure it as pref equity too. I mean, so preferred equity essentially does the same thing, but it sits in the waterfall as equity. So if you run into issues with a bank like that, you can just switch it to pref equity, which is a fine position. I mean, I actually know a fund right now that's liquidating almost $1 billion in assets just so they could take their LP equity positions out and put it back into pref deals because they feel safer in the middle than they do on the common equity side.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a ground up development. Like this thing wasn't cash flowing from day one. So how did that 12% get paid out and distributed to the investors?
So it accrued during development. I know some guys do a pref reserve sometimes over raise to pay the investors, but I don't love doing that because you're essentially paying investors with their own money. Right? So you can do it. It's just got to be laid out in the private placement memorandum that you're going to be doing a preferred reserve. But in construction loans, you need a debt reserve already. So we already had to raise an extra $2 million as debt reserves just in case it went sideways. So we just accrued it until stabilization, which was about 28 months.
Okay. Okay.
But here's what we did. How do you get investors comfortable with that are all around the country? We did spend the extra, I don't know what it was, maybe $1,800 to run a separate electric line and put a pole out with a 360-degree time-lapse camera. So every week, we'd send the time-lapse update to the investors so that they could see the progress going on, which was really cool.
Wow, that is awesome. That's like really creative. Like, who came up with that idea?
Our partner, Sean, must have come up with it because we never did it before. So I don't think we would have thought about it.
I might want to leave that on construction sites for other reasons, but
yeah, 100%, right? Make sure that nothing goes missing, but it's really cool. I mean, especially after we did three of them, when you put those all together and you watch a 30-second video of a $14 million project go up from the ground, fun to watch.
Yeah. So fast forward, you close the deal. This is your first deal. Like you weren't the operator on it, right? You just raised the money for it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we really took every step along the way with our partners. We had input. We didn't make all the decisions, but we were kind of there for, we told them we wanted to learn this business. So we wanted to not just write the check and go away. So we were very much involved in the entire process, but operationally, yeah, he was a general contractor. He's built a lot of developments. He knew how to structure general contractors and timelines and deal with the city for approvals and all that good stuff.
Sweet. So we got about 5 minutes left on the actual podcast itself before we end up going to live Q&A within our Facebook group.
Cool.
So I want to kind of like bring this deal full circle. We'll definitely have some chance for, I have a ton of more questions about this deal and probably our audience participants do as well. But you raised the money, you closed the deal. What did that deal do for you as either presenting an aha or even like financially in terms of like what it actually pays you each year, assuming you still own it or if you sold it?
We portfolioed the entire package and sold it. But those three deals made us millionaires, all of us involved. We didn't pay taxes for the first time in 10 years because our depreciation was negative. So even though we made a bunch of money, we didn't have any income tax that was due on it because of the cost seg studies. And essentially, it made me shut down my single family business because I saw what was possible on the other side. So major changes through that first deal.
Awesome, man.
Thanks for listening to the Investing with Purpose podcast. If you're finding value, would you leave us a review and share this with your friends? And go to investingwithpurpose.org to learn more about how to partner with us and to learn more about the nonprofits that we support around the world.